Back in 1994, Newsweek published an interesting article about angels and God. It was several years ago, and I don't think, even though several years have passed, the percentages have declined. But in 1994, 20% of Americans said they believed they had received a revelation from God. In this same study, they talked about angels, and 13% of Americans who were surveyed said they had either seen or they had sensed at some point in their life the presence of an angel. Now, when at least 10% of a nation's population says we've had this experience or we believe this or we're persuaded about this point, unless it's a real small country, that is a very significant thing. And tonight, that's really the subject that we want to explore. The text comes from Hebrews chapter 13. And out of all the angel texts that we could study in the Bible, this is perhaps one of the most intriguing. It certainly has raised a number of questions. When we think about angels, as we said, there's a great deal of interest in this topic. Many want to see an angel, or they want to somehow be in the presence of an angel in this life. If you think about that kind of thing, Hebrews 13, 1-5, especially Hebrews 13, 2, is a passage that comes to mind. In Hebrews 13, 1, we're going to read that in just a minute. The writer talks about having brotherly love and concern. He talks about Christians continuing in these things. And then as you look a little further into the chapter, you have verses 2 and 3 that kind of rounds out the thought. And the general theme here is Christian compassion, love, hospitality, and concern. If you found that last chapter in the book of Hebrews, let's start with verse 1. Let love of the brethren continue. Forget not to show love unto strangers, for thereby some have entertained angels unawares. That's the key verse. Remember them that are bonds as bound with them that are ill-treated as being yourselves also in the body. Let marriage be held or had in honor among all, and let the bed be undefiled. For fornicators and adulterers God will judge. Be ye free from the love of money, content with such things as ye have, for himself has said, I will in no wise fail thee, neither will I in any wise forsake thee. As we consider these verses, especially Hebrews 13, verse 2, there are some questions that naturally arise. For example, in verse 2, who are the strangers that the writer refers to? We also would ask, as we look at the text, in verse 3, who are those who are in bonds, that is, people who are prisoners? Who were the people, these some, who entertained angels? Well, those are three good questions. Let's start with the first one that was raised. Who are the strangers in Hebrews 13? When you look at the Bible, as far as early history and certainly other things that we have outside the scriptures, you find that since very early in man's time on the earth, people have been traveling for one reason or another. People have left their homes for either a short period of time or maybe they took an extended trip. When someone leaves their local location and they go to another area, whether that is maybe just across the county or maybe it's to the other end of the country, they are a stranger. In both the Old Testament and the New Testament, we find that the people of God sometimes travel. I'm not going to read it, but a good parallel text is found in 3 John. Of course, there are no chapters there. It's just verses 3 John, verses 5, 6, 7, and 8. In 3 John 5, John talks about some traveling evangelists. There were people who were trying to teach the gospel in the first century, and these people traveled in different places. And John refers to these brethren who were doing this travel in two different ways. He refers to them as both brethren and strangers. Now, we would expect brethren to describe Christians that they knew. And strangers, of course, would mean brethren that they did not know. In Hebrews 13, I'm understanding the word stranger in that same sense. It would describe those who were traveling teachers, people who wanted to communicate the gospel. They would go to different areas and places, and sometimes they would find fellow Christians in those places. Because of that, and especially given the circumstances of the Hebrew letter, there was a great deal of persecution. The writer says, when these folks show up in your community, you need to show love. When these brethren from out of town come into your locale, you need to show compassion to them. You need to help them because they are trying to do a good work. They may have had a need for food. They may have had a need for lodging. They may have had a need for clothing or medical care, or maybe all those things or some other item. So that part of the text is not difficult to interpret. Well, we then come to the second question that was posed. The writer talks about those who were in prison, the people who were in bonds. We would use perhaps the word restraints or handcuffs. Well, when we think of someone in prison, we generally associate that individual with bad behavior. That is, he's committed some kind of terrible crime, and he needs to be locked up because he is a danger to other people. Well, that's certainly true, typically, for our culture. But that's not always the case when we look at other parts of the world. There are places in our world, just as there were places in the first century world, where preaching the gospel of Christ is a crime. Preaching a message about New Testament Christianity can get you locked up just as fast as killing someone in certain places, even now. Well, given again the overall context of this letter, Christians were facing persecution. This seems to be the right thought. There were brethren who were faithfully trying to proclaim the Word of God, and they were mistreated. Some of them were actually put into prison for it. And that's why the writer in 3b refers to those who were ill-treated. As Christians were imprisoned or as they were trying to go and teach the gospel, the writer gives a general command that we looked at. You need to help these brethren. You need to assist them in their work. Imagine, if you will, being in the first century, you are a Christian, you're trying to do what's right, you're trying to communicate the will of God, and you end up in a particular place where you're a stranger, don't know anybody in town. But you do find, by asking and by looking, maybe there was a sign that identified where the people of God were meeting, you do somehow find that there are some Christians in that area, and you decide to go up and introduce yourself. How awful it would be. Can you imagine visiting those people and they don't have any interest in you? That's a discouraging thing. It's bad enough in our society to go to an area that's out of our local place, and you know, we just are passing by, perhaps for the morning, we stop for worship and we get the cold shoulder. Some of us have had that experience. But you know, we can get in our automobile and we've got a number of options where we can just continue on down the road, and we just kind of brush that off. But that really was not the case with these folks. They were in a different set of circumstances, and it really was a very serious matter. So it's as if the writer is saying to these Christians, I want you to hold up the hands of those who are teaching. I want you to hold up the hands of those who are being persecuted so they will not give up as far as their faith. Then he says, to encourage you to do that, I'm going to give you two reasons for acting in this particular way. One reason is found in 3b. He says, you also are members of this body. Well, initially you may not quickly grasp what the point is, but it's not that hard if we think about it for a minute. Essentially, the writer is saying that one day your lot in life may be the same fate as what these people are now suffering. Those who received this letter may not have been in a place where they and other Christians were being imprisoned. Maybe they were in a set of circumstances where it was not very often that they went out of town. They were basically homebodies. They were in their particular place, and they may not have ever gone more than 5 or 10 miles from home. And because these things were fine with them, they could have said, they could have reasoned, well, we're not that concerned about those who come into town. We're not concerned with those brethren who are being persecuted. That's not our situation. And they just had the tunnel vision to see what was happening in their local situation. The inspired writer said, you don't want to think that way. You do not want to reason in that way for this reason. A day may come when you're incarcerated. May not be today, may not be tomorrow, but that time may occur. You may not be a stranger now as far as you're leaving home and going to other places, but one day that may change. You help now, because one day you may be the person who's on the other end of the stick. A time may come when you need that help, so you go ahead and you aid those people now, and then one day that kind of help can be returned to you. Well, again, that's not something that's difficult to understand. Things become more complex when we look at the second reason. The writer said, I want you to aid brethren because some have entertained angels unawares. Well, what did the writer have in mind when he made this statement? Well, we're not told. There is simply no more information in Hebrews 13 beyond that statement. So if we can find additional information about what he is describing, it has to come from some other section of the Bible. Well, if that information does exist, it seems to me that one of the cross-references that we would want to turn to is back in the Old Testament. First book of the Bible, Genesis chapter 18, as well as Genesis chapter 19. We start with Genesis chapter 18, and you remember that in 18 and 19, we're dealing with the time of Abraham and Lot. Abraham in Genesis 18 showed hospitality to three beings who are at least initially described as men, who appeared to him in the plains of Mamre. He did this without knowing their identities. He did not realize they were angels. If you've turned back to Genesis 18, let's start with verse 1 and read all the way down to verse 8. And Jehovah, well, that's interesting. And again, this relates to the angel of Jehovah. He was one of the three that appeared. Jehovah appeared unto him, that would be Abraham, by the oaks of Mamre, as he sat in the tent door in the heat of the day. And he lifted up his eyes and looked, and lo, three men stood over against him. And when he saw them, he ran to meet them from the tent door, and bowed himself to the earth and said, My Lord, if now I have found favor in thy sight, pass not away. I pray thee from thy servant, let now a little water be fetched, and wash your feet. Rest yourselves and wash under the tree, and I will fetch a morsel of bread, and strengthen ye your heart. After that ye shall pass on for as much as ye are come to your servant. And they said, So do, as thou hast said. And Abraham hastened in the tent, and said unto Sarah, Make ready quickly 3 measures of fine meal, knead it, and make cakes. And Abraham ran unto the herd, and fetched a calf tender and good, and gave it unto the servant. And he hasted to dress it. Then as we come to verse 8, And he took butter and milk, and the calf which he had dressed, and set it before them, and stood by them under the tree, and they did eat. Now, as we said, one of these beings was deity in the flesh. We see that a little later, emphasized Genesis chapter 18, verses 9 through 14. The other two were simply good angels. These two angels that were the good angels, the regular angels, if we can describe them in that way, continue on as far as their earthly journey. As we read through the text, we find that they went over to the area of Sodom and Gomorrah, and they met up with Lot and his family. Now, in Genesis chapter 18, Abraham literally entertained angels unaware. He did not know who they were until some information was finally disclosed. Well, then they show up, two of the three show up on Lot's doorstep. And Lot has the same kind of experience. He did not immediately recognize these beings as angels. He thought that they were just men. He surely, just like us, had seen all kinds of strangers come to the place where he was living, and maybe just as on a number of other occasions, he simply offered basic hospitality to those who came by. Genesis 19, 1-3. And the two angels, now we're down to two as we noted, came to Sodom at even. And Lot sat at the gates of Sodom, and Lot saw them and rose up to meet them, and he bowed himself with his face to the earth and said, Behold now, my lords, turn aside, I pray you into your servant's house and tarry all night. Wash your feet, and ye shall rise up early and go on your way. And they said, Nay, but we will abide in the street all night. And he urged them greatly, and they turned in unto him and entered into his house. And he made them a feast and did bake unleavened bread, and they did eat. Well, you have in both the case of Abraham and Lot, these men entertaining strangers, and literally they entertained them unawares, at least for a period of time. Well, let's go back to Hebrews 13 for just a moment. The word that is translated unawares in Hebrews 13 simply means to escape notice. And that's precisely what we have in Genesis 18 and verse 19, at least for a time. The angels show up to Abraham, and he's unaware that they're angels. They show up on Lot's doorstep, or at least at the city gate, and it escaped notice, at least for a while, that they were angels. There was no glowing halo. There was no shining clothing. There was nothing, at least initially, to indicate that these creatures were from heaven. Their supernatural qualities were simply hidden. They looked like someone who was from the street. Now, most would agree that this information is correct. I'm not aware of anybody that would dispute it, at least those who believe in the Bible. But we're still left with some very important questions. One of those questions is this. Did the angelic visits that we find in Genesis 18 and 19 end with that period or with that dispensation of time? Well, there's some subjects about which we're not 100% sure, and this is certainly one of them. I would not suggest that we can draw some conclusions with absolute certainty, but there do seem, as far as I can tell, to be some reasonable conclusions that we may draw. The first conclusion is this. If angelic visits completely stopped with the Old Testament era, why does the Hebrew writer mention them in Hebrews chapter 13? Why base an argument on something if that item in no way, shape, or form no longer exists? That doesn't make any sense. Suppose an insurance agent shows up on our doorstep and wants to sell us a hurricane policy for our Indiana home. Would you buy it? Well, I think most of us would say if we were in Florida or if we were in a state where we had some possible damage from the coast, we would be interested in that. But we would not want to buy a hurricane policy for Elkhart County, Indiana. There simply is no basis for that. Well, and that really is the same kind of logic that we would apply to Hebrews chapter 13. One of the two reasons that the writer gives for treating brethren in a good way is based on entertaining angels. And that seems to suggest or imply that these Christians could have somehow been tested by angels. And that conclusion is, for me, very difficult to dispute. The difficulty, though, becomes this. What do we mean by an angel? I think sometimes as people see the word angel, they immediately conclude that we're dealing with some kind of heavenly creature. But that is not a correct conclusion. The word angel certainly does mean that in some passages. But you know, it means more than that. The word angel is simply a word that means messenger. In a number of passages in the Bible, and we're dealing with the New Testament now, angel means or describes a human being. Let me give you an example. In James 2:25, we remember the story about Rahab. The spies were sent into the land, and Rahab was responsible for harboring some spies. Those messengers that she kept, James 2:25, that is the same word that is translated angel in Hebrews chapter 13. So just because we see the word angel and entertaining those angels, that does not necessarily mean that we are dealing with a supernatural creature. Furthermore, we have this consideration. There is no promise in Hebrews chapter 13 that this would happen. The writer simply makes the point that people had entertained angels in the past. Had they entertained supernatural creatures? Yes, they had. Genesis 18, Genesis chapter 19. Could people have also entertained angels in the sense of human beings? Well, yes, they had. James 2:25 talks about Rahab entertaining the angels in the sense of human messengers. So again, there are a number of considerations that have to be borne in mind as we look at this particular passage. Well, the big question that people really want answered, the million-dollar question, is what about today? Is it possible? Might we as individuals ever entertain an angel? And we're not talking about another person. We know that that happens. But we're talking about entertaining an angel in the sense of a heavenly creature. Again, I don't know that we can be 100% certain, but I am fairly confident in saying no, that is not going to be something that occurred. First, as we noted, this was not a promise. The writer said it's a possibility, and certainly it was a realistic possibility, but there was no guarantee of that. Also, we have this consideration. In Genesis chapter 18, when the angels appeared to Abraham, he finally realized that these fellows were not normal human beings. Lot came to that same realization in Genesis chapter 19. So if those two passages do indicate any kind of pattern, that would seem to suggest that angels revealed at one point or another that they were not from here. And yet we don't have that kind of thing promised for our day and time. Angelic intervention among men in the first century was certainly something that we find in the book of Acts. But there were some other things in the first century that we find as far as miraculous gifts. And the Bible teaches that those passed away. There was a supernatural era there, but that era is no longer the case. God has given us his full, his completed, his final revelation. And that's the third reason for concluding, at least being fairly positive, that angels are not functioning in this way today. In Genesis chapter 18, as you look at the angels, they revealed information to Abraham about a son that was going to occur. In Genesis chapter 19, as they appeared to Lot, they indicated a lot. They revealed information about what was going to happen to Sodom and Gomorrah. And yet, as we look at today, what do we find about Revelation? God has given us the faith that's been once for all confirmed. Jude, verse 3. So again, angels, when they appeared, they're associated time and time again with revealing information to man. But since we now have God's completed revelation, that would seem to be one more proof, a very strong proof, that angels are not doing what we see in Hebrews chapter 13, at least not the supernatural angels. As we look at Hebrews 13, it's not a passage that's useless. What we need to do with this particular passage, though, I think, is view it in a way that people may not normally view it. So many times people get hung up on the idea, well, can we actually host or can we have some kind of contact with the supernatural being? That, to me, does not seem to be the key point that we want to take away from the text. The practical point is how we interact with strangers and brethren who are afflicted. If we have, for instance, a person who comes to our services, a stranger, that is a stranger, and it's possible for us to interact with that stranger in a number of ways, we can avoid them. We might just pass by them, go to the other side of the room, and pretend like they do not exist. It's possible to give a quick greeting to that stranger and then just move on. Or it's possible to make that person really feel welcome. But the bottom line is that there is a stranger in our midst, whether that's at a worship service or some other time, and it really doesn't matter if that person is a human being or an angel. I don't think it is going to be an angel. I think there's great evidence against that. But ultimately, it does not matter. The key point is, how do we interact with that particular person? Are we kind? Are we helpful? Are we courteous? Or are we not? People often look, as we noted, this particular passage from the wrong perspective. On Sunday mornings, we're dealing with 1 Corinthians. I dealt with this same section of the Bible about 15 years ago, and now, in part because I'm working on, hopefully, a new commentary for 1 and 2 Corinthians, after the material is presented here, and it's all fresh material, I go back and I review what I presented about 15 years ago, and I take the new, with that old stuff from about 2 decades ago, and then I combine all that material together along with the information that's already been assembled on 1 Corinthians 13. I went back this past week to look at some stuff that had been preached about 4 weeks ago and to tie that in with some things that we're doing now, and I was a little surprised. I'd forgotten about this. It had been a long time ago, but I made some lengthy comments in a sermon probably 15, 16 years ago about a congregation's failure. Don't remember all the details, and I didn't put down the person's name, but from the notes long ago, there was a situation in Fort Wayne where we had a stranger who was coming on Sunday nights. Don't remember who the guy was. Just that information simply doesn't exist. But based on what I'd written, he apparently came and came and came and came and came. And one of the things that struck me as this person came, and again, it could have been months. I doubt it was years, but it looks like it may have been for 8 or 10 months. He didn't get any kind of greeting from most of the folks. And that struck me as odd. And I guess it finally made its way into a sermon. But as I thought about that, the point crossed my mind as we look at Hebrews chapter 13 and verse 2. How sad that is not to treat strangers well. Sometimes they're brethren, sometimes they're not. And the writer apparently recognized that this could be a challenge for the people of God because he says in Hebrews 13 verse 1, forget not to show love. We need to show that quality as we deal with people, especially as we think about Christians who are suffering. And that also was part of the package. How ungodly it would have been in the first century for people to have been afflicted in various ways, and for the Christians there who could have done something to essentially just turn their back, close their eyes, and pretend like their brethren did not exist. Can you imagine that? I can understand why the writer says what he does in Hebrews chapter 13. It was a very serious matter. And he used those two points to help these brethren act in the right way. Let love of the brethren continue. What a beautiful verse, Hebrews 13, verse 1. And that's a crucial verse for us 2,000 years later. It's a verse that we need to cement into our minds and be sure that we do our best to follow every single day we live. Let love of the brethren continue. Is that how we're trying to live the Christian life? We hope so. Because that's a clear statement in the Word of God. It's one of the things that we need to do to please God. If you've not yet become a Christian, then tonight you can become a child of God. And then you can know and understand the love of the brethren. And you can let that develop and continue in your life. It really is a beautiful thing. Make strong churches, make strong people. Tonight, if you've not yet become a Christian, you can enter into that spiritual brotherhood by faith, repentance, confession, and baptism. And then you can continue on in the right way. If you're subject to the invitation, will you let us know as we stand and sing the selected song?